Welcome to the Readings Podcast, a production from Melbourne's leading independent bookshop, Readings. This episode was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. On behalf of Readings, I'd like to acknowledge traditional owners of this land and pay my earnest respects to elders past and present. Thank you. In today's episode, a recording taken from the launch of Irma Gold's novel, Shift. Gutsy and gripping, tender and deeply compassionate, Shift is a compulsively readable story about the messy process of art making and the mess of love and family. It is an unflinching, insightful and immersive novel that takes the reader inside the inner life of one township in South Africa, beyond the hyperbole of newspaper headlines, to offer bold, big-hearted hope. In the year of the 70th anniversary of the Freedom Charter, which outlined the principles of democracy and freedom in South Africa, comes a novel set in the township where it was signed. Shift asks us to examine both the world around us and ourselves. To introduce, here's Readings Marketing and Events Coordinator, Lucy Dess.
Hello everyone, welcome to Readings. My name is Lucy, I help run events here at Readings, and I am delighted to be here this evening to launch yet another wonderful book. Now, I would love to introduce you to the lovely Catherine Collette, an internationally published author of books for children and adults. Her most recent book is The Two Tall Tales of Alma T. Best, which she illustrated with her own cartoons. Catherine used to co-host the First Time podcast and now mentors and coaches writers and authors. She posts about her writing on Instagram at Catherine Collette Writer.
Thanks, Lucy. I am so excited to be here tonight to launch Irma Gold's fabulous new book, Shift. I wanted to begin by talking about the fact that Irma has five brothers and this book is dedicated to just two of them. This is a fascinating choice.
You're going to cause trouble, aren't you, Catherine?
I have dissected it at length. I think that there are a few ways we can interpret this. I think it comes down, there's two main ways. The first way is that the two brothers are her least favourite brothers and she deliberately waited to book 11 to acknowledge them. The other option is that they're her favourite brothers and the other three are sitting at home right now, staring into space and wondering what they did wrong. Fascinating choice, keeps people on their toes.
Well, do you know what? Three of them are supposed to be here and none of them are here yet. So I think I'm going to strike out those two names anyway.
Great. Yeah, good. I love it. I think it's a bit of a cliche to say that Shift is a novel that makes you think, because honestly, lots of things make you think. Tax returns, IKEA instruction manuals. Sometimes just being asked if you want a bag will make you think. But while tax returns and IKEA instruction manuals make you think in a way that starts with hope and ends in despair, Shift makes you think in a way you actually want to. I'd liken it to putting on an expensive anti-aging serum while eating chips. You get all the benefits, in this case the wisdom and the insight, without much struggle. At first glance, Shift appears to be about Ali, who is a moderately successful photographer who sets off to South Africa in search of something. I don't think he exactly knows what it is he's looking for. But the story is also about something bigger than that. It's about the stories we inherit, the weight of history, and the limits of what we can truly understand about the places that we visit and the people that we meet. That bigness is what I love about books. Great books like Shift don't just tell a good story, although obviously they do that. They also grapple with big ideas and they sneak up on you and they quietly rearrange your thoughts while you're not looking. And I think there's only one other thing that I can think of that can shift your perspective in the same way that storytelling can, and it's travel. You think you are going somewhere to see things, maybe to eat the food, perhaps to experience the thrill of buying a power adapter you will never use again. And before you know it, you've gained a new perspective on something you didn't even realise was up for debate. I once heard Annabelle Crabb say that when someone writes a long-running series, which, to be clear, Irma has not done, but bear with me, they will eventually run out of ways to describe their protagonist having a cup of coffee and they'll start to repeat themselves. I don't think Irma would ever have that problem, based on her books so far and this book in particular, if she wrote a never-ending series, I think every coffee could be uniquely observed. And that's because Irma is a writer who notices things that sometimes the rest of us miss. Whether that's the way a pair of sliding doors scissor closed as someone steps through, or a rundown Uber held together with gaffer tape that looks like it's been discharged from the hospital, there are so many wonderful images and sentences in this book. If you follow Irma on Instagram, you'll know that she's often by water. She's a paddle boarder, and she strikes me as the kind of paddle boarder that's out there not so much to win a race, maybe for fitness, but mostly because paddleboarding is a nice way to experience the world. And that, I think, is about the best thing you can aspire to in life, not just to move through it, but to really pay attention. Shift is a book that is all about paying attention. It's about noticing the details that shape us, whether we realise it or not. So, before we move on to the Q&A, I want to say congratulations. It's a remarkable book and a remarkable achievement. I think there are some valuable lessons in there. One is about paying attention and bearing witness to the stories around us. The other is, of course, that if you write multiple books, someone somewhere will keep track of who you dedicate them to. And to Irma's other three brothers, maybe next time. Let's get into it. So Irma and I are going to talk for about 20, 25 minutes. So we'll start with a very easy question. Where did the idea for this book come from?
Well, firstly, I want to say thank you, Catherine, for your beautiful words. One of the loveliest things, as you know, many of the writers in the room will know, is when you've been working on a book for so long by yourself, you've had hardly anybody read it. And so when you start hearing what people think about it, it's quite amazing. And to have such a thoughtful and attentive reader like you, Catherine, is a gift. I said this today to Catherine, so I'm very lucky to have her here. The idea came from a trip that I did with my brother Albert, one of the mentioned. So we were in Soweto, and on the last day there, we were at a bit of a loose end. So we'd done kind of all the things we were planning on, and we were like, well, what do we do today? And, you know, I always find with travel, that's when the best things happen. And we decided to go to the Freedom Charter Memorial. And when we were there, we met this guy, Bongani, who said, hey, do you want me to just take you around Cliptown and show you what it's like? So there's 1.8 million people in Soweto, and Cliptown is kind of in the heart of that, but it's weirdly not considered part of Soweto. It's a bit like the ACT being in the middle of New South Wales. But in Cliptown, there's no electricity unless you patch in illegally. There's no sewage systems. There's no rubbish collection. There's no school. So the kids have to walk really long distances to get to school. And there is upwards of 70% unemployment, but it's more like 85%. So we had been staying, before we went, there's not many places you can stay in Soweto because it's not a place tourists go. So it's either the youth hostel or it's Mama Flossie's, and it's kind of like this boarding house style place. And before we came, I had said to her, Albert's already laughing, I'd said to her, I'm travelling with my brother, right? Travelling with my brother. Yes, darling, no worries, no worries. We arrive and there's been like a blackout, which often happens in Soweto, so there's no power. They take us to the room and there is a double bed and all these candles laid out, and they go, oh, we've made it all romantic for you, A-A-A to Albert, and we're like, holy shit. So then everywhere we went, we were always like, this is my brother. So anyway, so we met Bongani and he took us all through Cliptown, and we met his cousin Jacob, and something about that experience just sparked. And then I went back again with my brother Roland this time, the second person who it's dedicated to.
There's an alternate reason.
There is a reason. they happen to be my two youngest brothers. Yeah, so that was kind of the moment where it was totally unexpected. We spent, I think, maybe 4 hours with him and, you know, just going around him telling us all about the place. And then the next time I went back, it was, that's where I was going.
Interesting. It pays to say yes, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
So the main character in Shift is Ali. What is life like for him when we first meet him?
He's a bit lost. So he's a photographer, but he's struggling to make ends meet. He needs to take photographs of weddings to supplement his income, and he teaches at university. I mean, it's a kind of common story for anyone who works in the arts. Most people are having to supplement their income in some way or another, and that's where he's at. But he's kind of in this space where, you know, around him he feels like everyone's, you know, achieving things in their career, in their personal life. He just seems to be unsuccessful at keeping a girlfriend, and another one's just broken up with him. So he's kind of in this space of not knowing what to do. And it's a conversation with his mum, who grew up in South Africa but doesn't talk about her time there. And of course, he's deeply fascinated by the fact that every time he tries to raise it with her, she shuts the conversation down. And so because of that, he decides that he will go to South Africa and he will put together an exhibition of photographs. But he's really drawn there because of this silence around what happened with his mother there.
Interesting. You have a family connection to South Africa as well. What is that connection, and has it woven its way into the story?
Interesting. I don't know that it has woven its way into the story, other than that I became kind of obsessed with South Africa because of that family connection. So my grandpa is actually French and my gran is English. My grandpa was a spy in the Free French, and they, after the war, they actually moved to South Africa, where he was working at a perfume factory of all things. And so my dad was born there in the year that apartheid began and grew up there. And I was always really fascinated with it as a country. And when I was about 14, I read Biko, which I don't know if anybody has... Yeah, people are nodding. It's an amazing book by Donald Woods, who basically uncovered everything that happened to Biko, who was murdered under the apartheid regime. And I got so fired up by that book and the injustice of it all, and I just started reading about the freedom fighters, and then I went on to fiction, you know, Doris Lessing. And so I just read kind of obsessively about the country and always wanted to go to Soweto. But in fact, Albert and my other brother Roland had been to Soweto 10 years before I got there, so it took me a long time to get there.
Interesting.
But as to, you know, how it actually fed into the story, I don't think it particularly did. I don't know. Maybe my family can correct me on that.
Okay, so in Cliptown, Ali falls for Glory, and their relationship's really layered. There's not just romance, but there's culture, there's expectations. What interested you most in writing about their dynamic?
I love Glory. She's so feisty and outspoken, and I think one of the things that I loved about being in Cliptown is people are very open and they're very honest, kinds of things that we would only think they will say. So, like, for example, people would say to me and Roland, "It's so weird that you're travelling with your brother." But, like, cool, like, we love it, but just weird. We're like, okay. So she's very outspoken, and she's an incredible gospel singer. And I think for Ali, she really gets him to see things in different ways. So, for example, he has this really kind of fraught relationship with his father, but she has a very different way of seeing that because of her experiences, and her father has, you know, disappeared and she hasn't heard from him, doesn't know where he is. So she sees him in a very different way. So I think she kind of calls him to account.
That's very true. Art is a real feature of this book. You mentioned that Glory sings, so there's music. Ali is a photographer. You've also made a book, which is, you know, writing is art too. It's easy to feel like when there is so much that's wrong in the world, there's war, climate change, all sorts of injustice, that the making of art is futile. What do you think the point of art is?
Just a small question. An easy one. I mean, art can be many different things, can't it? But I am a believer that art can change people's minds. I really do believe that. And I know, for example, with The Breaking, which was set against the backdrop of the exploitation of elephants in the tourism industry in Thailand, that people who've read that book, you know, say to me, "I'm never going to ride an elephant again. You know, I've changed the way I'm going to travel." And so, you know, that's a very kind of real thing that I've experienced as a result of that book. And, you know, there's books that have changed and opened my perception to the world in different ways. So I don't think it's futile, but I can relate to that feeling, and I remember having a conversation with my brother, Andrew, who I don't think is here yet.
Keep on running and telling you.
His wife's just like, no. He's a surgeon, so he's got a good reason, I'm sure. But because he's a surgeon, I was having a conversation with him about this, and I'm like, when you do something like that as a job, you are directly impacting someone's well-being. You're making a difference in people's lives. And, you know, I spend my life either writing or editing books. That's what I'm doing with my life. And I remember him saying, and I wish if he was here, he'd probably make some cheeky remark and correct me. But I remember him saying to me, yes, but art is what gives life meaning. And, you know, even in Cliptown, where people are struggling to survive and they might be eating one meal a day, there is music and dance and singing and, you know, the arts are, and culture is really present, and without that, life is just colourless.
Mm. Not to go too heavy into art, but there's a character in Cliptown who also paints. He's not a very likeable character, and his paintings are not very good. So do you have a view on what separates bad art from meaningful art? And is there such a thing as bad art?
Sure. So there's a few of the kind of smaller characters in the book are inspired by real people who I met. So none of the main characters are, but so his name's Cyril. There was this one day when our friend Z was just taking us places, you know, he took us to El Dorado and this street where there'd been four people shot in the last month. So, you know, anyway, he took us to this guy's house, and he had this tiny little shack that was probably one half of it was probably the size of this stand here, and that's where he had his bed. And then he had a curtain and another area that was about the same size, and he had like a studio. So he had an easel set up with his art, and he very much wanted us to admire this work that he'd done, which was not good. And after we left, Z said to us, oh yeah, that guy's a major drug dealer.
Oh.
And we were like, oh,
he
great.
He
took us to see him. He's like, oh, it's really dangerous. We're like, oh, jeez, okay. And we were just there going, making sort of pleasant noises about this terrible art.
I love how this novel captures that contradiction of being a tourist. So you want to be in a place, you want to see the things that are there, while simultaneously judging other tourists that are, you know, being tourists. How do you see tourism in this story? And is Ali a tourist, or is he something else?
I don't think he is a tourist, or at least not in the way that I would define it, because I see being a tourist as kind of skating over the surface of a place. Like, you're there to, I don't know, bungee jump or whatever it is you're going to do, but you're not actually necessarily engaging with the culture in any kind of really deep and meaningful way. And he really is, like, he's living there, he's trying to really understand the people and the community and their lives, you know, through his lens. That's the way he's kind of trying to like burrow in. But on the other hand, he's also an outsider, and he recognises that. And Glory says to him at one point, you know, you can always leave. Like, she can't leave. She's stuck there. But he can always leave. And he, by Australian standards, is struggling. You know, he's an artist. He's not earning a lot of money. He doesn't own a car. You know, he rents a little place. So by our standards, he's not doing that well. But by Cliptown standards, he's incredibly wealthy. There's that real disparity in the book where you can see the difference, I think, between how we would necessarily perceive that and how that actually appears in Cliptown. I mean, as well, so his brother Griff is doing very well. He's a lawyer. He's got plenty of money. But Ali can always call him up and say, I mean, he doesn't. Yeah. Ali doesn't want to, because he's the older brother, but he can. He's always got those options.
It's interesting, that idea of you can always leave is one way of putting it versus home, and that you always have a place to go and a home is sort of two sides to the one thing. One of the things that I kept thinking about in reading this book is this idea of inheritance. And so we often think about inheritance as you receive money when people die and wealth accumulates over time and maybe privilege. But there's also an element that if that wealth is accumulated by disadvantaging others, you sort of inherit a moral responsibility in some ways. And I wondered if inheritance was a theme that you thought about in the writing of this book. How much responsibility do you think we in the present bear for the past?
They're really easy questions, Catherine.
Sorry.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, particularly in the context of this book, you know, when you're in Cliptown, the past feels very present. In, you know, like Cliptown really hasn't changed much since apartheid ended. And I don't know if I said before that it's actually the place where the Freedom Charter was signed. So where all the principles for a free and democratic South Africa were laid out. So there is this beautiful monument in the heart of Cliptown where there is extreme poverty, all those things that I just talked about before. And Cliptown is, in all the places in Soweto, it's the place that most exemplifies how far there is to go. So the irony is enormous. And people in Cliptown talk politics all the time in a way that we don't talk here. It's very openly talked about all the time. And one of the things that I discovered there, which really shocked me, because we in the West all, I mean, well, certainly I did anyway, watched Nelson Mandela walk free. I remember, I think I was 15 at the time, sobbing, you know, in front of the TV. And to me, he was this absolute hero. And I could not have thought higher of a person ever. But there is a lot of disenchantment in Soweto now by the younger generation who see him as the broker of a broken freedom, which is, you know, something that, that comes through in the book, because nothing's changed. You know, in many ways, nothing has changed. So, yeah, history is part of the present. And it, I mean, I don't know what it takes for it to move on. But I also think, interestingly, I mean, this book is not about Australia, but there are parallels there with you know, we're very quick to sort of look at other countries. But, you know, apartheid came, I don't know, a lot of people don't know that it was actually the sort of the idea for apartheid came from the Queensland Protection Act that allowed the Australian government to remove First Nations peoples to missions and reserves. And that is where, you know, that brilliant idea was picked up by apartheid. And so all of the black people were moved from the Johannesburg town to what became Soweto. And that's still, you know, like when we're there, we don't see any other white people. It's still very much segregated, even though technically it's not. It actually still is. So, but yeah, I think there's a lot of parallels with Australia, yeah, actually.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the questions that I did have is that, I'm going to get the pronunciation wrong, Kazuo Ishiguro. He says he keeps writing the same book, circling the same themes. Obviously, the books are different, but the same stuff just keeps coming up and up. You've mentioned injustice, but you've written a lot of books now. Are there other themes that you...
Ten. Yeah, injustice, and even if you look at my last couple of kids' books, they're probably born out of sense of injustice as well. But, you know, there is one theme that nobody has picked up on. And I read, there's this blogger, Whispering Gums, who the literary people here will know. She's a massive supporter of me and she's reviewed everything I've written. And on my last children's book, she said, there are some really clear themes emerging. And I was like, oh, she's on to me. Because there's this theme that I know is in my work.
What is the theme?
Anyway, Catherine... She went on and said something and I was like, well, that's not it.
Oh, no.
And I'm not going to tell you.
Are you really not
going to
tell
us? I'm really not going to. It's one of those things that is nothing to do with anything specific, but I feel like it comes, you know, with writing, there are things that just come through subconsciously that you don't intend to put. Like, I think people often think fiction is about your life, especially when, you know, I've been to South Africa with the breaking, I've been to Thailand, and people think that it must somehow be a representation of you, and the truth is it's not. Because even when you use some scene, it's then through the characters, like how it works for that character, so it's not you at all. But the thing that I think is interesting is after you've written the book and you go, oh, that's in there, but no one would identify it as being related to you because it's some subconscious subtext there. So there is a subtext through all my books. See if you can find it.
That's interesting. I like asking writers about their themes because I think writers do know them and they keep coming up. I do think we circle the same stuff, whether it's conscious or subconscious. Writers love hearing about failure. Do you have a favourite failure, a rejection or a setback that in hindsight was good?
I love these stories too. Like on the podcast when people tell me about their events where there was like one person and there was this book and I wish I could remember what it was, like years and years and years ago, maybe 20 years ago, where they interviewed famous writers about their worst ever event. It's great. It's really, really good and it just makes you feel so good about life. The most humiliating experience of my life, which I'm now going to share with you, was when I was deputy editor before I was editor of Muse magazine, which was an arts magazine in Canberra. I was probably about 24, something like that. And I was a lot shyer than I am now, and public speaking was like my nightmare. Like, so I, even at uni, I hated doing like a presentation. And so I had to get up and give this speech. Can't remember what it was for, can't remember what it was about, but I remember the theatre. I can like see everyone in front of me. I know who was there, all these people that I wish weren't there to witness. And when I got up to give this speech, my voice just started shaking. And it shook through the whole speech. And it was so humiliating. Because I think at this stage I'd had maybe a few short stories published. You know, I was just, I'd finished my uni degree. I'd realised that you can't be a writer in a garret. And I'd started editing. And I was like, okay, this is my proper job. But I said to myself, if you're going to be a writer, you're going to have to get up in front of people. So I forced myself. I started a community radio show. And just forced myself to keep doing it. My voice never shook again, thank fuck. It was awful. But it's like over the years, I got from the point of being able to sort of tolerate it. And then I got to a point where I appeared really confident, but inside I was not. And now I love it. So it's such a weird trajectory. Like, I love nothing more than, you know, getting up and chatting at a festival or whatever it is. It's so fun. But it used to be like my worst nightmare, and that was my most humiliating moment. So thank you for ending on that, Catherine. Thank you all.
Emma Gold's Shift is available via all reading stores and at our website. You'll find all kinds of other recommendations for great books, music, film and TV. You can also sign up to eNews or to receive our free monthly newsletter, The Readings Monthly. The Readings podcast is produced by me, Nick O'Callaghan. The show's music is by Tom Hoskins. Thank you for listening.